Good morning, everybody. We better start, otherwise I'll have to go and apply for a larger room. My name's Jeff Atkins. Welcome to the real part of the convention. All of that other stuff in the big rooms, just fluff and nonsense. This is where the work happens. Can I introduce to you the presenters for this morning? First on my right is Ian Birmingham. Next on my right is Jamie Reid. On average, we figured that Jamie and Ian would meet dress code. Given that we've got a relatively short time, the 45 minutes is going to whiz by. The guys have suggested that we have discussion as we go along. There's only one logistical difficulty with that, which is that because of our commitment to prosperity in the World Wide Web, we're under very strict instructions to be recorded. So while Jamie and Ian are up there speaking, this roaming mic will be available, so if you can attract my attention, I'll dash out and pass around the mic. So, but feel free to pitch in when you find something interesting or confusing. Bios I have here. Ian Birmingham. Well, in fact, both Jamie and Ian are colleagues of mine at Affinity Consulting, Sydney-based actuarial and insurance firm. Ian's got over 20 years in insurance, he says, 10 years in health and life, including more than 5 years as a senior executive with MBF Australia. And as you would know, MBF's one of the organisations that's recently been through a adequately priced transaction. Yeah. So when Ian was at MBF, he was doing corporate strategy, mergers, takeovers, business rationalisations, growth and diversification, etc. So if there's anybody that knows about this stuff, it's probably him. And he was responsible for all aspects of the demutualisation of MBF and the $2.4 billion sale of MBF to Bupa.
$2.41.
Thank you. Now, Jamie is a POM, as you'll hear when he stands up to speak, but he's seen the light and moved to Australia a year ago, Jamie? Yep. Joined Affinity, where he's involved with general and health insurance work. Can I find anything interesting in here, Jamie? He worked in the London office of an international firm of consulting actuaries that shall not be named. Yeah, I think you get the gist. So Ian and Jamie are going to do a bit of a double show, and let's get it started.
See if I can figure out how to work this thing.
Probably wasn't expecting quite so many people, so it's kind of interesting. I think during the convention this year, there's actually a couple of papers. I think there's one from Andrew Gale later on that touch on similar issues, hopefully presenting a slightly different perspective on some of it. What Jamie and I were kind of interested in doing while we wrote the paper is, in life insurance, there's kind of an established body or precedent about how life insurance companies get valued. I think in general insurance is a generally accepted approach as well. I don't think health insurance is necessarily particularly complicated, but I don't also think the profession has ever sat down and said, here's what we think as a profession about how you approach this kind of thing. So part of what Jamie and I wanted to do was just put some thoughts down in writing and get some response or some debate in the profession. And if people agree with what we've put forward, that's great. If as a profession we don't agree, that's also okay, because at least we're having a discussion about what we think. I guess one of the other things that we observed is, and this is probably more the reporting that was in the papers rather than anything that the profession did, is there were some fairly simple metrics that the papers were reporting about whether this transaction was better than that transaction or how do you compare these two things. And the simple price per policyholder, I think, was, in our view, not taking account of some of the differences in capital structures and some of the other factors that were in the individual transactions. So we thought having a valuation approach that tried to capture some of those differences was probably useful. We do note, I guess, the last point down there, and I've had this kind of perspective put to me a couple of times by people who aren't actuarial professionals but who are corporate value and valuation kind of people, that, you know, it's an art, not a science, so there's all this mystical stuff that happens in the background, and every individual transaction has its own features that, you know, only corporate finance kind of people can get their heads around. maybe that's true, maybe it's not true. But again, as a profession, it would be kind of interesting to have a starting point on some of that. There are people in this room, I guess, who've been associated or involved in health insurance far longer than I have. But when we ran this session internally at Finity as a dry run, we thought it was useful to just kind of put a snapshot of the industry up. So we went back about 10 years and tried to look at both the constituents or the makeup of the industry as well as, you know, the overall levels of profitability. And a couple of things I think that we'd observe is, firstly, in the last 10 years or so, there has been a shift in the industry from not completely not-for-profit, but substantially not-for-profit, to a slightly more commercialised industry with more taxpaying entities commercially run, commercially driven, and certainly making adequate profits. One of the other observations is we went from some 40-something odd health funds down to a number that's probably closer to 30. So there's certainly been some rationalisation in the industry, not just over the last 3 or 4 years, but before that. And the profitability, you know, $4.7 billion worth of premium income up to about 12.8, and an industry that, if you put aside 2008, where the investment markets were a bit wobbly, over the last 3, 4, 5 years prior to that had been consistently improving profits. And now there's about, you know, over a third of privately insured people have their policies issued by a for-profit insurer. And one of the things some people are interested in is whether that, in the long run, makes a difference to the policyholder, or whether it's actually, you know, no different. So if we... Sorry, and what we've done here is we've tried very deliberately not to just represent the paper, so we're actually touching on different things. We've assumed that everyone read the paper coming into the session. If you haven't, that's okay, it's there, you can read it afterwards. And as Jeff said, please throw questions as we go. Comparing some of the recent transactions, we went back to 2002, and what we've done at this table is try and represent the purchase prices in modern day dollars, so adjusted to, I think, 2008, Jamie. And we've tried to express it, firstly, what the total purchase price was per policyholder, then the purchase price if you look at taking out the net assets, so the goodwill per policyholder. And then this last column that we've titled the realistic one is, you know, based on models that we've come up with, trying to estimate what the likely capital requirement, the regulatory capital requirement, was for any individual health insurer involved in the transaction, and then allowing for a 30% buffer over and above regulatory, so keeping some of the capital out of the net assets that's used to actually run the business. Yeah. And so if you look at NIBs, one of the interesting ones down there, there's actually three values there. That's just picking three of the different share prices at points in time that we've just called low, medium and high. If you look at all the other ones, though, the very right-hand column, you'd notice, with the exception of NRMA Health and NIB, there's a relatively consistent or constant price per policyholder that appears to have been paid. And one of the things I found interesting about that was, I guess I expected in the more recent transactions to see higher prices, reflecting market exuberance. And what we observed is that a lot of the high prices that were paid seemed to have been paid for the capital that had been built up in the business, and general economic growth in premium levels, as opposed to just over-the-top prices from the market. And that'd be an issue I guess I'd be interested in having people think about and maybe ask questions about now at the end of the session. What I might do now, Jamie, is ask you to come up and talk a little bit about the actual valuation approach that was suggested.
Okay, great. So just a quick slide on approach. So we cast quite a wide net to look at valuation techniques. So both the established life and general and the techniques that have been used for health, but we tried to cast the net a little wider to some broader valuation techniques that aren't generally used in the insurance industry. And there's a bit of a flavour of that in the paper if you get a chance to look. Having done this trawl of evaluation methods, our preferred approach combines a discounted cash flow approach with a terminal value. The terminal value is based on a capitalization of earnings approach. That's another name for a price earnings multiple method. Why did we pick this? Well, we think in the short term, a discounted cash flow method allows you greater precision. So there is a point in looking at the cash flows over the short term where you can have a reasonable stab at guessing what they might be and how they might grow. Beyond an initial few years, it becomes pretty difficult to pick these cash flows with any real certainty. So then we suggested, well, you're probably just as well going for this multiples approach. And having sort of prefaced this slide with describing all the research we did, the wider methods, I guess we should note that the method we've come back to is a pretty standard method. It is a method that's been used in a lot of recent transactions in health and more broadly. A little bit about our model, in case you're interested. So what we're trying to do is project future P&Ls for health insurance companies, so profits going out a few years. We look at the premium income of the company, the starting point now, and increasing it year on year to reflect rate changes and changes in membership, new business lapses. We project the claims and the expenses, assuming that on average, and here's the first interesting assumption, I guess. So we're assuming that the net margin is fixed. So on average, year in year, there's no real scope to grow net margins over time. Equally, there's not a lot of squeeze on margins over the long run. You might get 3-5% on average. So I guess why we're happy with that is with the competitive environment, but more particularly the way the prices are set, that we're happy to assume no change in net margins. And of course, we need to add the investment income as well to complete the P&L. So we've projected the year-on-year profits. Next, we need to calculate the capital requirements of the business. So two parts to that. The first part, the regulatory capital requirement, which we can build up piece by piece from the projected asset and balance sheet. And then we need to add a margin, as Ian was saying, a margin, and we assume a 30% margin over the regulatory minimum. So we've got the amount of money the business has, its assets and its profits. We know how much it needs to stay in business, both the regulatory minimum plus a margin. So anything extra we've taken as profits and as distributable money, and we pay that out in some way. So then the value of the business is just the present value of these distributions, these dividends, if you like, plus some sort of terminal value which we let kick in after 10 years. And one other point is that we had to make adjustments in a number of cases where health insurers are owning non-health business, so retirement aged care or financial services business, which won't be picked up so well in this premium and claims outgo approach. I've put up some of our assumptions just for completeness, but I'm going to gloss over this a little bit. If you're valuing a company, then these assumptions certainly wouldn't be something you could gloss over. So whether you assume 2% net policyholder growth as we did, or 1% or 3% is really important when you're valuing a company, and the other assumptions likewise. But we're trying to do something a little bit different here, which I'll come on to a minute. So the point of these assumptions is just to put a reasonable, defensible value in each cell. And as they came up, I could see it in your eyes that you were saying, oh, I wouldn't have assumed 10% discount rate. 12 is the minimum for me, and details like that. So there's a flavour of that in the paper. There's legitimate discussion there. But for our purposes, we're just trying to put reasonable picks in so that we can move on and get a reasonable assessment comparing like with like for each company. So what did we do? We've built a valuation model. Are we going to value companies? Well, no, we didn't value anything. We came at it from a slightly different angle. We looked at the four most recent transactions, and we didn't try to give a view on were these overpriced, were these underpriced, what should the value be? Should AHM be 400 million or 300 million? We took the prices as given. And we took all these other assumptions as given, the ones on the previous slide, the discount rate, the growth rate, and the investment income, and so on. So having fixed all these assumptions, having fixed the value, we tried to say, well, what net margin is implicit in the purchase price? So given that you've paid 367 million for AHM or for the others, and given that you pick sort of reasonable assumptions for everything else, what sort of margin do you need to make on your insurance business to justify the purchase price, so to back solve to the value? So here's the results. So what we're saying is that in order to justify the purchase price for AHM, we think AHM needs to get a 4.75% margin. MBF a little bit less, so just under 4. Manchester Unity, again, a little higher, so 4.25. And NIB, 2.75. And that's NIB at 85% per share, which is more or less what it started at and more or less where it is now. We've got some of the net margins up there, so the net margins in the last 5 years. So I guess three observations on this. The first observation is that the trend in the margins we think are implied by the purchase price is a bit like the trend in the margins achieved. So AHM has had some very good results in recent years, and that appears to be reflected to an extent in the price. MBF less well, and there's a differential there. I guess the second point is that there's a big range in there, so there's a big difference between a 2.75% margin and a 4.75% margin. It's not 2%, it's an enormous amount of money. But having said that, I think what we would take from this, which maybe wasn't our view coming in, and maybe wasn't the view you'd form looking just at press comments, is that all of these margins that you have to get to justify your price, they're not outrageous. They're margins which you could possibly achieve. So, given the historical levels of profitability in the industry, so the conclusion is that having picked a reasonable set of assumptions, we think that the values look reasonable given the net margins you need to achieve. So, okay, so having done that, the next thing we tried to do with our model is try and change some of the other parameters. So, say, change the growth rate assumed, change the investment return assumed, change the amount of capital buffer you hold, and say, well, which of these other parameters that we've got in the model, which of these really make a difference to value? Which are the drivers of value? And which other parameters, when we change them, doesn't really change the value, less sensitive? So what's the drivers of value? And there's some bits and pieces in the paper where we show the scenarios, the low, the high, the effect on net margin required of changing these parameters. So first observation out of that is we think policyholder growth is a real key driver of value in a business. And it can be a bit of a complex relationship between growth and value, in that if you're growing a little faster, then initially that limits your distribution, so it has the potential to limit your ability to pay a dividend to your shareholder, because you've got to keep some money back to finance the growth of that business. There's some sort of new business strain there. But over time, if the business is written profitably, if the products are sensibly designed, that business will generate profits and that can be distributed. So this growth generates value. And if you think you can generate growth from a business, then you can assume, you can make more ambitious assumptions in the margin you price to initially, because you can count on new business coming in to repay the initial purchase price. I guess another angle to the new business argument is that it can have a very direct effect on margins, where you're successful in attracting people who are new to PHI to your business and you have the benefit of the waiting period there. Just switching to the table at the bottom, perhaps we see a flavour of that in the data. I guess there's a lot of things in this data, a lot of moving pieces other than just growth and margin, but we have there the four companies that have been involved in transactions. We have the rate of growth they've had in recent years in policyholders, and we have the margin that they've been able to obtain. So the high growth insurers, AHM, Manchester Unity, grew faster than the others, and they had higher net margins on average, and NIB, less sure what's happening there. I guess thinking this through from the other side of the table, a lot of our work was, and our modelling is a buyer side perspective, so valuing using initially public information, assuming that the taxpaying entities, so which is the route that these companies have taken to demutualise. Looking at it from the seller's side for a moment, if you're a business like AHM or Manchester Unity, or and you've been enjoying this high growth and you know growth creates value, then I think you would have an expectation that that should be reflected in the price of your business. Just a note on a couple of the other value drivers we looked at. So we looked at investment income and margins, so capital margins, capital buffers held in the business. Investment return obviously has a significant impact, and the same would be true in general insurance. So if you're in a low margin business such as a lot of general insurance and health insurance, then an extra percent return on your investments, it has a large percentage of your overall margin. So obviously that has a significant impact. The impact on the size of capital buffer held is less significant. So this is about whether you hold 30% more capital than required by FIAC minimum, or you hold 20%, or you hold 40%. And even though changing those buffers releases a lot of money from the business and has an ongoing effect in terms of the amount you can release in each year, obviously that's offset by the lost investment income. So if you reduce the amount of capital held in the business, then you also reduce the amount of investment income to the business. So looking at value overall, there's not a huge effect in whether you keep the capital in the business and pay out income on that, or you distribute it. Having said that, to both of these things, if a business picks its risk appetite and decides the level of risk it's comfortable with, then in a sense these other pieces fall in behind. So if you've stated your risk appetite and that will dictate how ambitious you can be with your investments and how much you can earn on them and how much capital you feel you have in your business. So the knowledge that you can drive income from this isn't necessarily helpful if you can't do anything because you have a fixed risk tolerance. I think that this is an example of one of the bits that we didn't necessarily cover so much in the paper, but we wanted to say a couple of things about synergies. So in each of the recent transactions, when you read the IMs or you get a flavour of the talk around them, synergies has been something mentioned in each case as a reason for demutualisation, a reason for merging businesses. And purchasers have talked about how they'll extract synergies, avoid duplications in the companies they've purchased. One feature of this synergies debate is that they're always picked up in part as synergies is something that can reduce premium inflation. So there'll be lower increases in premiums going forward because of synergies. So I guess insurers perhaps are acknowledging that it's unlikely they'd be able to keep these synergies themselves as excess profits. So it's unlikely they'd be able to use these to grow their net margin. So they'd be under pressure to release these through lower premium inflation, as they claim. But I guess the reason for thinking about synergies is we have, on the one hand, people buying these businesses which have high growth characteristics and have experienced higher growth than the companies acquiring them. And through this modelling, maybe we're seeing that actually that a lot of money has been paid for this growth premium, for this business which can grow faster than the market average. So we have growth and value on the one side. And on the other hand, we have statements about businesses trying to extract these cost synergies. And we're thinking, do these things necessarily sit beside each other all that well? And when you think about where these synergies come from, I think that's where you have to be mindful of these points. So top-level synergies you can identify easily. So you only need one CEO, you only need one board, and perhaps there's a few top-level synergies sitting in this room at the moment who are identified as cost savings during these mergers. at the front line, perhaps it's harder to identify these synergies. So you've still got just as many policyholders as a combined business. They phone up just as often. They claim just as often. So that all needs to be processed. So it's in the middle areas where judgment needs to be made in extracting synergies. And I guess the point we've made there is that when you go around looking for cost savings, it's important not to trim too much off the areas of the business which you've purchased, which you think have been the engines of growth. So the teams that or the features of the business which have been producing the growth. So just before we turn over to debate and discussion and we move around to the microphones, I guess we're saying that for a management team that's purchased one of these businesses, that in order to justify the purchase price, in order to make it a success, the businesses really do need to be mindful of what's driving the value that they paid. And in particular, if growth in memberships is the target, if growth in memberships is what drove the purchase price, then that's the critical goal for management. Okay, over to you, Jeff.
So the guys have given us 10 or 15 minutes for discussion.
Name
the exactly.
Okay, Stuart Roger. So firstly, thanks very much for the paper. It's a good paper about a topic that we haven't got anything written down about, so I think that's an important gap in our literature that you've just filled. My question is around your use of a terminal value, and if you're discounting at 10%, but if the profits that you're valuing are growing with premium inflation of 6%, and I wasn't sure, but possibly net membership growth of 2%, it seems to me that the terminal value that you're assuming is going to be quite a high proportion of the final value you calculate. The figures I did before hearing you speak now, I was assuming that you were only valuing the existing members, and I was thinking that maybe it's 25% to 33% of the value, but actually if you're taking net membership growth into the valuation, terminal value is a much higher proportion of your final value. And I wondered if in the kind of numbers you played around with, you'd looked at how much the value varies according to whether you use 12 or 13 or 11, a kind of a number that's pretty highly judgmental.
So your terminal value, as a discount rate or as a multiplier on the terminal
value? As the multiplier on the terminal value versus the more sophisticated modelling of the first 10 years.
Okay, to try and pick up all those bits. So one is that your calculations are right. It does tend to be about a third of the value which lies in the new terminal value. It's not so sensitive about moving out a year or coming back a year, because as you say, you're out so 11 years or 12 years, because you've got 10 years of discounting at 10%, and you're sort of swapping a year of cash flow for a year of multiple. I think our preference coming into this would be that you could get away from using the multiples. So I know a number of the published valuation approaches in the IMs just use a multiple. So we were hoping to go all the way the other way and sort of preference for cash flows initially. I think why that struggles a little bit for a health business is because there's all this growth. So even if the penetration rate remained level, you would still get a lot of premium growth. And because of the premium growth, your capital requirements are growing. So there's a lot of value which is locked up in the business and isn't recognised in the distributions. And if you use a pure cash flow approach, it's hard to find a sensible way of recognising the value which is locked up in the capital in the business, which is growing and growing and growing each year, but isn't recognised. So I think we would have coming into cold, had a dislike for multiples because they are, there's a lot of judgment in the multiples, but I think in practical terms we need to use that.
And having said that, I think you're right, Stuart, that that's an area of judgment. Perhaps that's the bit where it falls to being more an art than a science. But a perspective that I had on that is, you know, if you imagine that you run this business successfully over the 10 years of the cash flow period, you have a business then that still is worth something. So it's not...
I'm not arguing that there isn't a terminal value. I'm just asking about you've reduced the
quantum
judgment element from 100% of the judgment of the price to it's still 30% of the price.
Yeah, and I think the other element of that is by the time you get out to 10 years, depending on the discount rate, the uncertainty around some of those cash flows, I think, does start just getting a little bit uncomfortable. You know, so I don't know what's going to happen with government policy. I don't know what's going to happen to, you know, whether there's substitute policies or substitute products and all that kind of stuff. So I accept what you're saying, that, you know, you've gone from 100% judgmental to maybe 30% judgmental, perhaps a step in the right direction, and whether you can get from 30 down to zero depends on where you have less discomfort, you know, around the selection of the judgment or around the selection of the things like your discount rate.
G'day, Peter Carroll. G'day. Thanks for the paper. I suggested to Mark Bishop a couple of years ago, he wrote a paper on this topic. Very pleased to see you here today. I'm still waiting for the paper.
Can't
find
it.
Delivered by proxy.
Two issues for me that I'd be curious to have your comments on. One is tax, which your patents are on the side, which obviously is an issue. Some of these companies that are now demutualised are really still mutuals, they're just subsidiaries on the mutual. But nevertheless, there's a tax issue here. NRB is a true tax paying company. The other is the relationship between the value of what it costs to get a new member by acquiring another firm versus all the other ways of getting new members. I'd be interested in your comments on those two.
Deal with the first one first, Peter. So tax, I think in preparing the paper and the valuation model that Jamie and his guys build, we assumed that the thing being sold, or the entity being sold, was a tax-paying entity, and that has been the case, as far as I'm aware, for each of the things. The fact that they have then become subsidiaries of a mutual organisation is, I think, for the purpose of what we were looking at, kind of irrelevant. I think so, because if you look at...
I'm curious to know.
Well, ask people in the audience their views.
Everybody's gone that way, which suggests it's a very good argument for going with that.
Well, I think in part, if you wanted to acquire the business as opposed to have a pure merger, I think you have to go that way.
Yeah.
You could pursue a merger rather than an acquisition. That's a kind of a separate issue. That's my view on tax. I think tax is a necessary issue. If you want to structure a transaction as an acquisition, you have to convert to being a shareholder company, as far as I'm aware, and that carries with the implications of tax paying. A mutual company can then do what it wants to with the asset once it's got it. In terms of the second part of your question, I can talk a little bit about the experience that we had inside MVF, where, you know, I think expense analyses, or the sophistication of expense analyses inside health insurance companies, probably varies. But I had a view that it was probably in the order of $500 or $600 per policy to acquire a new member, and then there's ongoing costs. That's not including the capital that you have to put up and all that kind of stuff. I think the issue that a lot of the organisations try and balance is they can pay $500 or $600 or $650 for an incremental policy for organic growth, but if you're trying to achieve market share in a particular state, or if you're trying to achieve some kind of a significant growth pattern, it'll take you an enormous amount of time to do that. So part of the trade-off with an acquisition, if you're looking at then paying more than that, is you're actually getting kind of scale and volume all at once. So not only would you pay, in these examples, a control premium for buying all of the asset, but you actually pay a strategic premium, if you like, because you're achieving some kind of strategic objective much more quickly. And different organisations, again, I think, will put different prices on each of those things. Sorry, guys, there's one up the back.
Yeah, g'day, Mark Hancock. A couple of comments. Thanks for the paper. I don't think I've seen one on this topic before, as I think a few people have mentioned. I think when you look at valuation for HR, you can't get around the fact that it's a different industry to the other industries actuaries work in. It's much more highly regulated. We've got the community rating model applying in a short-term business, and we've got the strange reinsurance pool. So every valuation really has to constantly, I think, refer to these issues. And I think in terms of all sensitivities you talked about in the paper, which you've highlighted a good list there, the ones that I think constantly confound and frustrate valuation work is the annual rate approval process, and also the political uncertainty about lapses and how new governments could change that environment. And I think I heard you say something about assume constant net margins. It's we've had a fairly favourable run on net margins. We haven't on investments, but we have on net margins, and it's a very dangerous sort of place to sit with that. I'm a bit of an investment actuary, so I take on board your points about the discount rate and the investment rate. Perhaps one thing that's good is to just look at the gap and take the gap in mind as one of the key issues. And also, when you're picking an investment rate, really look at how the assets are being deployed and what actual assets are being bought with those, rather than picking an accurate, a single trying to beat an accurate rate. Overall, given the expense, the problem I said on margins and rate increases, probably one of the best things to look at is actually expense rate and efficiency as a measure of value, because in a community rate environment, if you can actually be a low cost producer, that's where management can create value. Thanks, Jeff.
Sorry, hopefully we've got time for first Duncan, then Andrew, if that's okay.
Duncan Rawlinson, thank you for the paper. Just a couple of observations, if I may. I find it quite a fascinating line of business in terms of the underlying characteristics of value. And leaving aside the political risk for a minute, my initial reaction coming at this from the perspective of doing economic valuations on the life insurance side is that its inherent defensive qualities from a value point of view and relatively low correlations to some of the things that increasingly care about on the life insurance and wealth management side. So for my money, I probably think about a discount rate as differentiated between, you know, how much risk premium is in there for the fundamental kind of characteristics of the cash flows of the business relative to investment risk, for argument's sake, and really start thinking about some of the challenges that these businesses face in terms of political risks of many dimensions, some of which have just been alluded to. So, I mean, maybe it's just a personal preference to think about those two things separately rather than washing them both up in a single risk discount rate. Probably the main issue that I would take with the comments that have been made is from a value point of view, other than some second order things, I don't think it matters how the assets are being invested. Your point about risk tolerance, well, if the business has arrived at a lower risk tolerance from which flows a less risky asset strategy, that should be reflected in a lower risk discount rate from a valuation point of view. There shouldn't be value creation or destruction from an economic value point of view according to how the assets are being invested, because that's suggesting an arbitrage that doesn't exist. Now, it's not quite as pure as that, I know. There will be second order impacts in there, but that's probably the main reason to my mind to differentiate in when thinking about discount rates between the underlying characteristics of the cash flows and admittedly some really quite challenging issues when looking at these businesses compared with life insurance and general insurance around the political risks and the many manifestations of that, whether that's through the premium rating process or whether that's through continuation of tax relief on premiums or anything else.
We've got about 2 minutes. Let's hear from Andrew.
Ian, thanks for the paper. Just perhaps follow on from what Mark said about, you know, you've determined that the implied net margins in the valuations are in the range of 4 to 5%. That's certainly been the experience of the industry over the last 3 years. Go back 7 years before that, it's about half that. Go back the 10 years before that, it's actually -3. So a 20-year view, more like 0.5%. I suppose my question, comment is around the sustainability of the 5% margins that are aligned to the recent
pandemic. And I think the best way of trying to answer that question, Andrew, would be again to say that we didn't set out to try and value the companies and therefore come up with a margin we thought was sustainable. It was more saying, what do we think the new acquirers might need to deliver in order to justify the price that they've paid? And based on recent experience, that seems okay. You know, you can have a very, very different view if you want to go back 20 years. And going back to the conversation we're having with Stuart about terminal values and, you know, the comfort about long-term cash flows, I did and do start getting very uncomfortable looking out 5-10 years or so, and that's one of the reasons we thought a terminal value approach, at whether it's 5 years or 10 years, is up for debate. But I think the fundamental issue is, you know, how did the organisations who paid whatever price they pay actually realise that value? And some of it's going to depend on growth, and some of it's going to depend on net margin.
Let's call it quits. That was definitely our last bell. Join me in thanking the speaker.